we always said as a team, always just give your best. When you then know that the rest of your team is giving the 100%, it's amazing what you can do to your body and how much you can push yourself.
It's given me a load of confidence. I think I went in incredibly underconfident before. It's massively tested me on so many different levels that I wasn't expecting it to test me on. And at points during this whole campaign, I didn't think that we would get to the end. And I had to massively narrow in my horizons and kind of be like, okay, just take one day at a time.
I think there's a lot of potential in the military, and I think a lot of people get underrepresented, and I don't think everyone gets a platform. And unless you see potential in people, people slip through the net, people leave the military. And I think there's so much potential that doesn't get recognised.
We're in for a treat with today's episode. We meet four inspiring women from the Army's Force Atlantic team who successfully rowed an ocean and finished as friends. Bonded by challenge, commitment, sacrifice, danger, and laughter, you'll hear the depth of their team spirit as the intensity of their experience takes I've Got Your Back to a whole new level. From the get-go, the team was handpicked through a thoughtful and thorough selection process, laying the foundations for something truly special. There's no doubt they've smashed their three aims to promote, inspire, and belong. It's been life-changing, empowering, and I'm honoured that we're about to share the brilliant story of four women, one boat, and an ocean to row. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Becca, Emma, Immy, and Sherry.
Hi, I'm Immy. I'm a physiotherapist in the Army, and I was the skipper of the team.
I'm W1 Sheridan Lucas. I'm in the Royal Logistic Corps, and I was logistics lead.
I am Beck Glover. I am a doctor, currently doing my general duties years with one medical regiment in Tidworth.
And I'm Emma. I was part of the QAs, which is now no longer the QAs. So, yeah, I'm in a new corps now.
You've just spent 46 days together on Rosie, your boat. You've obviously got to know each other really well during that crossing, but as I understand it, you spent some considerable time beforehand working out who the team was going to be. And I think, Immy, you led on that.
Yeah, I think it was really important that when this all started, I didn't just want to fill the boat with the people that were close to me that I knew. So we mandated that it had to be 50-50 officer soldier to begin with. And then we put out the feelers to the whole army and we tried to get that out as wide and far and as wide as we could. We had over 110 women apply to begin with, from private all the way up to full colonel. And then we just spent a whole year and a half narrowing that down. So we did multiple different selection events. So the first one was just asking everybody for their why. We narrowed that down then to 60, and then we took everybody to Sandhurst, which was cool. So we did a bit of a fitness test. And then we took 20 of those. We didn't just take the top 20. We took the top three of the officers and the top three of the soldiers. And then we chatted as a team with the support team about everybody else and who we thought would kind of fit. And then we took everyone on a week of event training to get people a little bit more tired, put them in a little bit more of a stressful environment and see how they coped. And again, we then didn't just pick the people that had excelled the best. And then we layered people together. So we layered the officer soldiers together to get our final seven. And then we spent 6 months as a final seven in the team, or a final eight, including myself, to really get to know each other. Before then, we, with the help of our sports psychologist, we narrowed that down to the final four.
Oh, my word. Unbelievably thorough. You could have done it very differently on the back of a fag packet, and yet you've gone through it in incredible detail.
Oh, I'm a bit of a details freak, but I think that's probably
you.
That probably shows it. But more, I think, for me, this has always been about people. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that it was about people and it was getting the right people together, and that high performance was based on diversity and it wasn't just having kind of like a whole yes team of people, and also bringing in people that you never met. And I think actually that was our greatest power, is that we never knew each other, yet we've all brought incredible strengths into the team. If you don't spend that time getting to know each other over such a prolonged period, you'll never know what people can bring to the party. And then we showed that, because then we overcame the challenges that we then experienced on the ocean, because rowing an ocean isn't an easy thing. As an individual, I couldn't have done it on my own. But because we'd spent so long getting to know each other, we got through it as a collective.
I think you've always been very appreciative of the fact that not everybody fits the mould that often the army tries to put you in and the kind of selection processes that you go through. So you tried to look at it with a slightly different approach, which is really interesting in a sense because I don't fit that mould. And I don't think we have any shame in saying that Em and I were both reserves. So between the Sandhurst and the adventure training package that we did, we didn't make the last 20 and we're on the reserve list. So actually, once we had that week together up in Anglesey, relationships completely changed. But again, it's how you actually get to know people in a selection process, which is really difficult and often can be done quite poorly if it's done in such a short space of time, which we're often time restricted and you don't have the choice to. But the fact that you spread it out over so long and enabled people to be their true versions of themselves then meant actually the team's probably quite different had you just made a decision on the first day.
Becca, that's fascinating. And I just wonder, Sherry, from your perspective, what was it like for you going through the selection process?
Yes, I've been through many selection processes. And this was quite different in the fact that it looked into the psychology. And it was for a long term, not short term. So I think short term, anyone can fake it till you make it. You can go through any sort of selection process and be what they want you to be. For this, it's very different. You know, we had the campaign pre-row, we had the row. But the vital part is post-row. And the way that Imi and her team carried out the selection made sure that post-row, we'd be able to go around and do the campaign and really deliver what we said we were going to deliver, which was to inspire other women. And we needed to have them friendships and bonds that were going to last through tricky situations. So you couldn't fake it. You really had to be your true self. So probably one of the most interesting selections I've ever carried out. But long-term, worth its weight in gold. Really is.
And Imi talked about the whys, and there'll be lots of people thinking, what on earth? Why were you doing this? Emma, what was your why that attracted the selector's eye?
I feel like a broken record. I say this all the time, but when I saw the poster advertised, it said something like, four women, one ocean, one boat or something. And I immediately was drawn to it because obviously with minority and, you know, opportunities like this are very far and few between in the army. They are there, but there's not many. A bit of time out of work with a bunch of crazy women, so why not? Initially, I was like, this looks amazing, just to even meet some incredible women. For me, that was part of it. And then further on down the process, the kind of why became stronger for me, in particular, being a soldier, not being an officer. That was a big thing as well, to promote women in these sort of activities. But even just to show other women what can be done in an environment that is so male dominated. Lots of different things, but those are my kind of two big ones.
You had three big aims, which were promote, inspire, and belong. How did you come up with those?
That was me.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Imi's talk.
So actually, there's a whole psychology around doing things in threes, isn't there? So I thought we needed to start with having three because it makes it catchy. And then I kind of thought, as the selection event showed, everything that we have done, I think, goes into depth and there's detail to it. So we are a minority being a woman in the military. So it was just to promote who we are and what we kind of stand for. Inspire others just because we have never rowed. We have never done anything on this scale before. And if we can do it, you can do it. That was kind of behind that. I wouldn't be able to do this, or I personally feel I wouldn't be able to do this on my own. But because I belong to this team and our wider support team, I felt comfortable and safe to then be my true self, which then unlocked all of our different strengths and weaknesses to allow us to then achieve something bigger. So they all had a slight kind of link, and then they all link quite nicely together.
And part of your motivation, I think, also was for charity, raising money for charity. And you chose a charity that's not a military charity. How did that process of working out which charity you wanted to support happen?
So the Girls Network is a really small charity that linked together girls between the ages of 14 and 19 with a mentor, a female mentor in an industry of their choice to kind of broaden their career horizons. Major Emily Lawson is in our support team. And she said, well, I mentor for this charity. I think that they would fit really nicely. And actually, when we started to look into it as a team, it just kind of aligned more and more. And the fact that they are so small, I think, means that, well, hopefully we can have a big impact and just showcase this is what we've done and how we've done it. And they're really, really cool. And hopefully we can have a big impact on them, becoming mentors ourselves and then also raising money. So again, it wasn't just about here's a load of cash. We wanted to make sure that what we did was more powerful than that and bigger and had more depth.
Well, we haven't talked about the row itself. Can I just understand the preparation part? What did you do to prepare physically?
So we're all from different backgrounds, whether that be different sports and work environments as well. So we actually maintained our normal jobs while training, but there was mandated training that we had to do before we could even get onto that start line of the race, which was 120 C hours together. Actually quite hard to fit in. And it doesn't sound a lot in the grand scheme. Like, we had a 3-year window here, and actually once we took it down to the final year, when we're getting these hours in and you've physically got the boat to be able to do it, it was quite a squeeze.
We're all active people. We all had different interests before. We all kind of maintained our fitness to varying degrees, but none of us are the same. So we had to kind of get ourselves to a baseline where we all were doing our best to avoid injury. So I had enough strength and conditioning to kind of avoid injury. The row is not about being at peak fitness. It's about consistency. There's a physical aspect, but a lot of it's actually the kind of mental resilience that it tests. We had a strength and conditioning program from Nicole that Victus performed, and that was individualized to each of us because, as I say, we all had quite different baselines. And then we did varying levels of, again, just trying to keep ourselves fit, get ourselves ready for the race. So some of that was rowing. I do a lot of running. Ems does some triathlons and stuff, don't you? So we kind of tried to keep ourselves interested in our sport. And that was important to all of us, I think, because as Sherry said, we were still doing all our work, our deployments. It was how we could fit it in around our schedules.
Trained in some really tricky places, but making it work. You have a commitment to the team. So yes, we all understood each other's jobs, but if you can make it work, I think we all had to make it work at tricky times in tricky places with injuries and adapting and making it just right.
The commitment and motivation to do that, especially when you're doing something that you've never done before and you're doing your day jobs as well, that must have been really hard. What was it that made you keep going to want to do it?
The commitment to each other, but also to the meaning of what we are. Our actual mission statement is what we wanted to achieve. I don't think I'd be able to put my hand on my heart and say, right, I can inspire others, I can promote it and feel I belong in this team if I don't give my all the time. And yes, there's times where that might be 50% of my normal, but it's all I can give them. So as long as we all give our 110% wherever we could, we were still belonging in a team. We were still inspiring others. We were true to form and true to ourselves. So it pushes you on.
Do you think that that level of commitment made what must have been horrendously hard, the row itself, easier? Or is there nothing that can prepare you for what it's actually going to be like?
This makes it easier. The bond that we've got between all four of us, the time that's put in before you get on the water really helped all of us to know each other enough. I think if we'd gone in there just, you know, smashed the fitness, got on a boat, got to the other end, yes, we would have achieved it, but we wouldn't have achieved anything past that. And we certainly wouldn't have gone for lunch together or been able to like hold our heads up high and contact each other still and go around and do a tour. Things can be really bad. And if you can make it lighthearted and you know when that person needs time out or you don't need to talk to them, or you know when that person just needs a smile. And that's all in what we learned pre-getting on that boat.
I remember when I first met Imi and Becca in October before you headed off, you said that success for you would be finishing as friends. But were there times where you felt that that was tested?
We'd done a lot of, or had a lot of the hard conversations before we went. So we worked with Pippa, our sports psychologist, loads. And we were, again, going back to kind of like the training, we saw that as an equal importance as to the physical side of the training. And so we had a lot of challenging conversations when we were at hers doing a retreat or a camp. And then we would often speak, I think. So there were definitely times that we didn't all agree. But I think also that's part of our strength, is that we don't all agree. And that we often would have to navigate through these conversations because of whatever challenge that may have been on the water or even before the water. But we had created a kind of a psychologically safe environment that we could be ourselves. And we could be like, no, I do not think that is right. And I think we're very good at sitting there to some degree and then moving through it and coming out the other side, having got an answer that we then all collectively agreed on. But don't get me wrong, there were some challenging conversations out there and there were some challenging times, but I think the work we did made it easier.
Becca?
I think being at sea 46 days together definitely shows people's true selves. I mean, I guess it's why we do adventurous training in the military. It's for exactly this reason, in the sense of you create those bonds with people by putting yourselves in incredibly challenging situations. And actually, you say, like, what kept you going? What motivates you? It's amazing how much
you will sacrifice yourself for your team when you're in those situations, because you know each other so well. And you know, we always said as a team, always just give your best. Now, as Sherry said, our best might look quite different at times, but we had enough trust in each other and we'd built that trust to know that that person, whatever it looked like, was giving their 100%. When you then know that the rest of your team is giving the 100%, it's amazing what you can do to your body and how much you can push yourself to help get the team out of holes and like to get us through. Nights are always the worst. Everything goes wrong at night. So it would always be what you could do to kind of get to sunrise. No one ever struggled to get out of the cabin for their shift, etc. Because you know that you're swapping with someone. There's never that doubt of, I don't want to do this, because you'd never leave them on the oars type thing. The bonds that you create as a team, the trust that you have within that team, which we can develop both in the preparation and on the row itself, kind of set those conditions to then be able to have that accountability.
Do you think that sleep deprivation was the toughest thing? Or what was the toughest thing?
I think it was different for all of us. I think it depends what you've done in your military career, in your civilian life, to what everybody found difficult at different times. Everything kind of links back to, we are four completely different people from four completely different backgrounds. And what we find difficult, somebody else would find easy. So we could all rely on each other. So even if you were finding it difficult, being in the military gives you like a weird sense of humour anyway. So while you're finding it difficult and having the worst day of your life, somebody else is actually making fun of that and it brings you up in a good way.
I think that was probably key, was the fact that it normally happened at different times. So yeah. Then Em would bring out the disco ball and we'd all have a party and that would make me smile. Or
sorry, hang on. You had a disco ball on your small boat?
Over to you about the disco ball, girl.
Yeah, we managed to get a disco ball on. Yeah, it was just a light.
It was more than a light.
Disco ball rest on and it just spun around and did a little light.
I remember on New Year's where Beck and I were on the shift before 12 and I was like, Beck, this is awful. This is going to be the worst New Year's ever. When they come out, I'm like going to bed. We can say Happy New Year and I'm done. And then Em comes out with this disco ball and just puts it on and puts music on and they're dancing for like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. So I think the disco ball had such a lot of power. It was quite a big thing.
For energy when you didn't think you had any energy. Yeah. So suddenly the whole boat was like a big party. It was great.
And I think, Em, you with the sleeve, I remember you had some wacky dreams. We said that you should write a book called Atlantic Dreams by Emma Gibb. Because the sleep death, I think, was something that you had these crazy dreams and then you were hallucinating at times and stuff like that, which is interesting.
What's the dreams? The dreams, like, yeah, I could always tell you girls what it was. I mean, I can't remember any of them now, but yeah, lots of dreams.
But you at the time, you could remember the dreams.
Yeah, I'd come out and be like, oh, is that another dream? And everyone's like, oh God, here we go. What now?
I think the hallucinations are pretty key though, weren't they? I mean, you nearly got off the boat so that Beck could get out of the cabin at one point.
And he's off the boat.
Yeah, you're like, oh yeah, I'll just get out of the way and went to step off. And I was like, oh, there you go. Can't get off the boat. You need to stay on. But Beck got out of the cabin safely.
But did all of you experience hallucinations?
No, Em was the only one, weren't you? Mm.
No one else? Just me?
Nope.
No. I think it's key to highlight everyone had different things going on though. I mean, Em's likes to wear shorts inside out. People would put clothes on inside out and whatever else because you are tired and you just put it back on and going on.
And we also didn't turn the cabin lights on for the entire crossing.
So the only thing, I don't know, Sherry was very regimented with the batteries. And so the only way at night that we had lights is we all have matching watches and they have a really small torch on them. So that's the only thing that we used at night. So no wonder, not just me, but a number of us came on with our shorts on back to front and inside out and our tops on inside out.
But presumably battery power conservation is really important.
Really important, yes. Everything we need to do, whether that's communicate, get in touch with our weather router, anything needs to go through the batteries. So I was quite regimental in the fact that, no, you can't charge your watch right now because we need this battery power for this. So that's what they're going on there at that point.
But it worked. It worked. We had a great power management. So actually, we needed Sherry to keep us in the darkness for 46 days.
Because and shorts on back to front was morale. So
your bra was actually inside out as well.
It was a sad day.
I would say that was actually really tricky to do up, but I nailed it.
Just to be clear, you didn't see anyone else for the whole time you were on the ocean.
On our second to last day, we had the closest ship that we actually saw, didn't we, come? So that came within 0.2 of a mile. It was a container ship that came very close.
But we didn't see any individuals.
We didn't see an individual.
We saw
the four of
a rather large ship coming towards us.
But you were communicating with family, presumably, under your battery power regime that Sherry was enforcing. You also had a radio, and I think, Imi, you were quite keen on using the radio.
Yeah, I got very obsessional with the radio, actually, because we weren't seeing anybody for 46 days. Sherry and I were in the cabin that had all of the communication and all the GPS, so I got very excited when we would see a ship come onto our GPS monitor. And quite often they were big ships, and we're very low to the ground, so they can't see us very often. And so a number of times they were aiming straight for us, which actually I quite enjoyed, because it meant that then I could ring them on the VHF and then I could have a full conversation with them. Often they didn't want to have a conversation back. Really roguely, in the middle of the ocean also, somebody rung our sat phone. So nobody really rang us. We could ring out. And it turned out to be Julie from Florida had got the wrong number. And so I had a full conversation, and I thought, I'm not just going to hang up here because, you know, I've only talked to these three for 46 days. I had a full 20-minute conversation from Julia from Florida, telling her what we were doing, our whole campaign, how she should follow us. It was great. It was a highlight of the trip, actually. So, Julia, if you're out there, thank you.
I eat like a five-year-old and pack a lot of sweets, a lot of chocolate bars, chewy bars. My snack packs probably took up the majority of the boat, to be honest, guilty. But these snack packs come in really handy. When the girls were coming off their shift, I'd quite often put a little snack on the seat that wasn't used and just roll it down to them and then close my cabin door, and it'd go down the treat and then you sort of barter over them.
Beck and I would refer to it as the tea trolley. So Sherry would go to bed and she'd shut the door, and then we'd hear this kind of like scavenging around, and then she'd come back out and she'd open the door and she'd just place these two little snacks on the tea trolley and then push it towards us. Yeah, we had slightly more boring snack packs in comparison with Sherry.
Apart from treats being left on the tea trolley, what other ways did you find to motivate yourselves, apart from supporting each other? But what was it that you used to motivate yourself? Was music important to you?
Because we rode 2 hours on, 2 hours off, we generally rode in pairs. And so the pairs just happened to be Imi and I tend to row together, and then Sherry and Emma tend to row together. But that was because Sherry and Imi were in one cabin and Emma and I were in one. So one person had the whole cabin to themselves when they were sleeping. The two kind of rowing pairs, I think, had quite different approaches to it. We basically spoke until we exhausted conversation and then switched to music, which came at varying points in the 2 hour shift, I think.
No, definitely. And I just, Beck brought no music with her. You had one song on your phone?
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, but I didn't download. Yeah,
you didn't download any music. So I had to inflict my music for 46 days onto her. So I would be, and we'd have it quite loud at times as well. We'd have a full on party, and I'd be singing at the top of my voice, and I think, and I couldn't see Beck, so I was full on going for it. And then you were just enduring my.
No. Like, we have quite similar taste in music, so the music I quite enjoy. It's all good.
Good.
Yeah, we used music heavily, whereas you guys didn't really, did you?
No, I think we're both comfortable with silence as well. So sometimes we talk, sometimes we'd have silence, but we did listen to quite a lot of audiobooks, Harry Potter biographies, wasn't it?
We had a lot of 90s music. I feel like morale came from the like 80s, 90s music,
That was M.
That was all brought to the party by M.
And then we had our team song.
M's playlist came out, yeah, we had a team song.
And dancing was pretty key. I mean, really small space for dancing. But
you've got to have pretty good sea legs. They didn't come out until about 2 weeks in, when we'd established our sea legs enough to be able to dance.
You talked about the horrendous things happened at night. Can you give us an example of what horrendous looks like?
Horrendous is different at different levels, but one of my favourite moments, which would probably give other people PTSD, is we had this one wave that we were all on deck for. The only way I can explain it is, you know when your family get on the log flume and there's the poor kid that you stick at the front that's taking the water, and then everybody else is going back in a row? Well, we're all on deck and Imi and Beck are rowing. I'm hand staring and Emma sat behind me. So I've got Emma like an armrest, wasn't I? I was like sat back on you like an armrest. We're now nose diving through the water, and this humongous wave came right over the boat, swamped the deck, and it was exactly like the log flume. We're just waiting for that camera to go off at the bottom. Like the most horrific picture you would have had of like pure shock faces.
But I think the best thing was, because obviously Imi and I were facing Sherry and Emma, so Imi and I were surfing down this wave at like 30 knots and absolutely loving it. So great. These two looked absolutely terrified
because
they were clearly like vertically. So that happened in the day, and as I say, in the day you can kind of see what's going on, you can laugh about it, everyone's awake, it's kind of okay. In the night you have exactly those conditions, but it's pitch black, so all you have is the light from the moon. And when there's no moon,
it's pitch black. You cannot see anything. So you can't see the horizon. So you therefore can't see when waves are coming. Every now and then you'd see white crests of water, which would stand out. And I'd be like, oh, I think there's a big one coming. And then just suddenly you can just feel the movement of the boat just completely shift. But you've got no idea what direction these waves are coming in. And you're getting thrown about from all directions. I was never worried about sinking or anything like that, but it's pretty terrifying when you can't see what's going on. You think you're just going to flip and capsize.
That night after the log flume night was probably the worst night, actually, I remember. And so those seas continued into the night. And so they were huge. There were probably about 30-foot waves that were coming at us and we couldn't see them. And so we put out a sea drogue. I had removed the retrieval lines from the drogue. And so we put this drogue out and the drogue goes behind and it goes into the second wave behind you to slow the boat down. So we could feel it working at the beginning and it was kind of like you would go down the wave and then it would slam and it would slow us down. At some point during the night, the drogue had ripped in two, but we couldn't bring it back in, so we couldn't tell.
We also didn't know that.
No,
until the morning when we tried to bring it back
in. And then we'd snapped an oar that night as well. And then we were doing 1 hour shift changes because we were having to hand steer and we were all cold and wet. I think we were all in full fowlies, but they were just kind of sodden through. Going back to your darkest hour is the hour before dawn, the kind of the sun rose and we were like, oh my gosh, we've survived. And like that was pretty wild. And then there was the madness of trying to get the drogue back in, which ended up with kind of Sherry nosediving down the boat with an oar trying to flick it.
Could you just give us an explanation as to what your daily routine was like on the boat?
Eat, sleep, toilet, clean yourself, sing, cry, all of those things combined into 24 hour.
That was basically our routine. We had 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we kept the boat moving forwards all the time, or tried to. And in that 2 hours on, you were purely rowing. In the 2 hours off, you were doing everything else. So you were washing, you were eating, you were resting, you were sorting out any nav, you were cleaning the boat, contacting home. So you ended up sleeping for probably about 1 hour 20 maximum of that 2 hours. And then in the day shifts, in your rest time, that was when we were making water. That was when we were fixing oars. That was when we were doing other bits around the boat.
I mean, 2 hours off sounds delightful now. We definitely didn't sleep for that 2 hours. So some days you'd go and you'd have 24 hours and you would have slept 3 hours within that 24-hour period. It really did depend on what was going on.
And do you have a day that sticks out above all the others?
There was this one particular day where we had two weather routers and they were from Australia and they were fab and they rung us and they were like, girls, it's going to be a horrendous 12 hours. And then we'd get these text messages, just the weather was awful. It was so hard to maintain our course over ground or the direction that we wanted to go. And literally all of us were giving it everything. And we kept getting these text messages being like 6 hours to go. And I actually only remember 6 hours because 6 hours just kept coming. I think he kept texting us 6 hours to go because it got longer and longer. I then died of fatigue. I couldn't actually sit upright anymore because I'd given everything. And so I was banished to the cabin. And then the next day, the sun rose again. And Beck, it was you who got in the water, wasn't it, to clean the bottom of the boat. And we had this car ice scraper. She gets in, she cleans off all the barnacles. We get back on and we gained like half a knot to a knot faster in speed. And then our morale just went from being the worst day of my life where I thought I was just going to die lying in the cabin being like, oh my God, I can't move, to then we were like flying. Music was pumping, you know, like we were all singing at the top of our voices. And we were just like, why on earth did we not get in the water sooner to clean the bottom of the boat? So yeah, lowest of low to kind of like the highest of high.
When you finally arrived after 46 days in Antigua, you had had this experience of just being the four of you, and then suddenly you were met by your families and the wider world. What was that like, Emma?
I think Bex described it in the best way. I think you said something like, oh, if we could just bottle this kind of emotion, like, because it was very unique. I'd never felt like it before. I don't think there's words to describe it, but it was very emotional. Just really nice to see people at the end.
What was it like for you, Becca?
You can see from the kind of finishing photos and finishing videos, it's pure elation. And that's the bit that Em said. I just said, I wish we could just bottle up that feeling because it was just so cool. When you've just given everything for so long and then you know that that's the end, and we had all our families, everyone's families kind of had come out. Sherry obviously saw a little boy as well. And there was just so much emotion, both huge elation, huge relief. There was an element of sadness, that's done kind of thing. We're stepping off the boat, but it was incredible. And then we then spent a week sorting out the boat and then with our families. And we were all absolutely socially drained because we'd obviously chatted nonstop for 46 days, but only to each other. Mm. And as you've probably kind of realised, there was kind of no boundaries. You could very happily sit in silence. You could very happily sing away together, chat away together. But suddenly, when you had to actually have formed conversations with people and everyone was so interested and you want to obviously give people everything, I think we all found it really exhausting, didn't we, to kind of see so many people and be in those crowds all the time. So we had to kind of socialise and then have little social breaks, go back and socialise again, just to kind of keep up with it. Going back to work, I think we're all now going to be used to it, but still, I think it was quite overwhelming, wasn't it?
Since you've got back, have you got a sense of what impact you've had already? And what are you learning more now since you've got back about the impact you're having?
In the build-up to the row, we were so internally focused on getting ourselves to the start line and the preparation that we needed to do, that we kind of didn't look out to see the impact that we were having or hoped to have. Since we've come back, what's been so eye-opening and so appreciative of it is the reach that we've managed to have through contacts, through friends, through people who we've met in our careers, through wider associations. The number of people who've become involved, who've taken an interest, who followed on social media, who've donated, who've spread the word has been absolutely incredible. Every now and then on the ocean, we had kind of a glimpse of actually somebody from a different walk of life that we kind of hadn't had contact with for years. You'd get a message from them and think, how's that reached them? But since we've been back, I think it's fair to say we've all been kind of overwhelmed by the support that we've had. Those are the individuals that we'd always hoped to reach, is to especially show younger children, younger girls, that the opportunities are there and actually what you can do. And as Zimmy said, it's about inspiring, but it's not about inspiring people to row an ocean. Well, if people want to, please do go for it. But it's not about rowing an ocean. It's about actually doing something that's slightly outside your comfort zone, and people's comfort zones will all be totally different, but pushing yourself or stepping out that little bit so that you can learn from it, so that you can build from it, so you can be a bigger, better person on the other side of it. And seeing the people that that's reached, who I hope will then get that message, has what's been really cool.
Now you are all back at work. What's next for you all? I mean, you're not planning on doing this again, are you?
So I might be.
Oh my word, really?
Yes, I'd love to do the Pacific, and that's on the cards. But ultimately, I need to give back to the army a little bit more first, and then look about getting a boat, and then trying to take over the Pacific with an all-women team again. So you've got to have done the Atlantic to be able to do the Pacific. But currently sat at 3 women, unless Beck's arm could be twisted.
I'm honestly, this is... You can't blackmail me publicly.
Yeah, I think I just did, yeah. Well, Amy's retired, and she retired the day she got off the boat, so I can't
twist
that.
So, yeah.
No, I know.
But did you know that already before you finished the road, the Atlantic, or did you decide that after you'd rowed?
I think on the boat it happened and came into my mind purely because of how it makes you feel when you're on that boat. For your mental health, for everything was just so powerful on there. And realising that actually someone who's never been on the sea and hated the sea to absolute love for it, and for what we'd gained and what I'd learned from, you know, these 3 other powerful people on the boat, and for what it gives back to me, actually I can still give a lot more back as well, and I'd like to just experiment in that space.
Amazing. Amazing.
Mad.
You talked about the impact it had on your mental health and how good it was for you. Did any of you also have that?
It was pretty life-changing, I think. It's given me a load of confidence. I think I went in incredibly underconfident before. It's massively tested me on so many different levels that I wasn't expecting it to test me on. And at points during this whole campaign, I didn't think that we would get to the end. And I had to massively narrow in my horizons and kind of be like, okay, just take one day at a time. And so now that we've achieved it and we've got the other side, I've been like, oh, wow, actually, I'm not incredibly sporty. I'm not incredibly clever. I'm just your average Joe. And I've been able to achieve something like this. And it has given me confidence to realise that I can go on and do other things, which is incredibly powerful, and things that I thought that I wouldn't be able to do. So I'm incredibly grateful for that. But I do not need to row another ocean. Just to caveat that. But there's things that once I maybe thought were, I would love to be able to do that, but I'm not going to now being like, maybe. And if I want it, I can go for it. And it's now more realizing that those challenges actually just, I now know the level of sacrifice that comes when you really want to achieve something. So it's now being like, do I want to put my full energy into that? So yeah, it's been a good confidence booster for sure.
Apart from Sherry's plan to row the Pacific, what's next for everyone else?
The experience I've had, it's given me a platform, right? So I want to use this platform somehow in order to help those achieve whatever they want to achieve. I don't really know what that is yet, but just using this as a way to help others. I think there's a lot of potential in the military, and I think a lot of people get underrepresented, and I don't think everyone gets a platform. And unless you see potential in people, people slip through the net, people leave the military. And I think there's so much potential that doesn't get recognised.
I think it's really important and powerful to say that Emma was probably in one of the most challenging positions before we went on the row. I think it was around February of last year, Emma was a reserve rower. And so she wasn't in the final four, but she still maintained and did all of the training with us. And she was still as committed and was fully involved right up until the point where then Kate and Emma switched positions. And that in itself was incredibly powerful. And I just think should be highlighted. It wasn't a smooth path in that you got in straight away, but you still gave 100% effort throughout the campaign, not thinking that you were ever going to row. So I think it's really powerful that now you've got the platform to tell your story.
Did you ever think, Emma, that this was what might happen in the future, that would give you this opportunity?
No, I just thought about it more and more, and I'm just like, oh, I'm not going to be in the military forever. And I've had my, not had my time, but I've done what I wanted to do. And I just think there's so many more people in the military. And it is, I hate to say it, but it is rank as well. There's so much more that can be done.
I wonder why that is, you know, what the bias is to not look for talent or ability or potential beyond.
Yeah, I don't think it is bias. There's so much out there, right? And if you're not in that space, you don't see it. Even at my rank and Becca's rank, we didn't know about ocean rowing, and we didn't know that this was an opportunity. It just takes one person to see that opportunity and then take it and run with it. And Imi did absolutely the right thing in having that focus of two officers, two soldiers. But having gone through a full soldier career, there is ample of opportunity, but it's whether you've been shown where it is. And I think that's what we need to be better at. We need to show where these things are to our junior soldiers so that we can develop them. And that comes from a passion in an individual, right? So it's got to be your chain of command is passionate enough to look after their soldiers. Let's allow everybody to see what is out there in order to then live it.
I think mentoring as well, like that's a big part of what we've said with women and with the Girls Network. It's a mentoring charity, but that's needed in the military as well. You need people to take an interest in individuals and individuals' careers, and people need mentors because, as Emma says, the opportunities aren't openly visible to all ranks. And so I think probably, Em, what you're looking at is how you can mentor people in similar positions to yourselves to be able to take up those opportunities that the army and the military does offer, because I think that's probably what we don't do so well.
The Girls Network has the catchphrase, you can't be what you can't see. That's incredibly important, because actually I really believe it. If you can't see it, or you don't see somebody that you can relate to, then you don't think it's possible for you to do it. And I think that's what you really powerfully, Em, can do, because you're passionate about it as well.
You've talked about the amazing opportunity you've had to do this row, as well as doing your day job. And I'm sure that you didn't join the army specifically to row the ocean, but there are some women serving in the army who've not had a perfect experience. What would you say to young women thinking about joining the army now?
I think for us, and I think this was a big part of our campaign initially, we acknowledged that women are very much still hugely in the minority in the military. And although that is changing, I don't think it will ever be 50-50. And so a big part of our campaign was, we want women to feel like they belong to a community, to feel like they can speak to each other, to feel like they've got somebody they can turn to. There's a team around them rather than people feeling like individuals, so that women have that network, which we appreciate may well have been lacking previously.
This experience for us has been really great. I totally know that that's not the case for everybody, but we just wanted to showcase that actually we were given this opportunity and we've met each other, and through working as a team and belonging, we had an experience that was like nothing I've ever had before, and that's been really powerful and then changing my future. Those do exist within the military and also outside of the military as well.
I think ultimately we're a product of society, aren't we? So everything that happens and people experience in civilian street, they experience in the military. And as long as we keep acknowledging that and we make positive change and positive influence, and we can really make positive influence with this and with the campaign. And as long as we keep doing that and everybody leans into it, every small thing is going to make a big impact and a big difference So it's really just looking at what we can do to move forward, keep encouraging women. A key statement for me is it's not actually a glass ceiling, it's a glass floor. And as soon as someone has opened that door for you or shown you where the door is, it's absolutely your domain and you can own it, run with it, accomplish and achieve everything that you want to achieve. And I don't think gender really comes into it at that point. It's just about you've seen an opportunity, you've taken a bit of risk with it and you've done it and you've learned from it. And then what you do with it afterwards is to help other women, to show other women, guide, mentor, influence and inspire.
Did any of you have quotations that you used to encourage you?
We had a
dino gun.
A dino gun. And I'd actually dino gunned and stuck it above our cabin, didn't I? All it said was, you survived yesterday, so quit tomorrow.
And it peeled off because our cabin is very wet.
Everything peeled off, but I still have it. It was in a pocket. I put it in the pocket of my coat and it came everywhere with me. And at times when it did get really bad, I was just being like, well, yeah, I do want to quit, but I'll quit tomorrow.
We did have some quotes stuck above our bed, didn't we? But one that we actually, Ims and I listened to on a podcast while we were on the row, which resonated so hugely, was the darkest hour is always the hour before dawn. And I think partly because, as I said, everything horrendous happens at night, so you would live for those sunrises. When you think you're at your worst, nothing ever lasts forever. It will always change. And so, again, if you always think it's about to get better, you're always looking forwards and not just getting stuck in your head in the moment.
That was definitely not your top quote. Your top quote is you could do anything for a minute. Every 2 minutes, like a day, you could do anything for a minute.
But it'd be, you can do anything for a minute times 65. That's how long we had left on the ship. Beck would, I'd be like, Beck, this is rubbish. She'd be like, you can do anything for a minute times 14. Then we're off ship,
and we did less profound, but that does get you through 46 days.
I hope you felt the amazing positive energy exuding from the studio. Their decision to row the ocean is making big waves in their lives, and the impact they are having is affecting many women, whether serving or not. I really love their reflections on opening up opportunities for women and the power of mentoring and advocacy. It's so true, you can't be what you can't see. They may never call themselves trailblazers, nor say they're extraordinary, but they've shown that you don't have to row an ocean to have your voice heard. I'd love to know what resonated for you. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.